The first papers presented at this session devoted to logos and art, or rather logos ke techni, challenge us to consider what it means to think of the verbal art of archaic Greek poetry as a techni, a question that was discussed this morning with respect to the visual arts by Damian Sutton. As Richard Martin reminds us in his contribution, the notion of techni, understood as craft, is an inclusive concept that encompasses much more than the narrow, value-laden realm of art, as that term has been conceptualized in the West since the Romantic period. What then does it mean to unthink our Romantic prejudices and recover a notion of verbal artistry, and in particular of that special form of logos that is poetry, as a kind of techni? The papers presented by Anton Birl and Richard Martin, and available online by Gregory Nagy, all have important things to say on this subject as well as others. In the few minutes that I have, I would like to highlight in particular what these papers have to say about one of the main themes of the Athens dialogues, the theme of the diachronic connection between the culture of antiquity and the ongoing unfolding of that culture today. In highlighting some of the consequences of the arguments of these papers, I would like to take my cue, like Dr. Sutton this morning, from the great theorist and polemicist of techni, Plato. Plato, of course, vehemently denies that poets like the rhapsode Ion have a claim to techni, largely on the grounds that their art relies too much on irrational inspiration. But Plato's attack on the poets is, in fact, the first step on the path that leads ultimately to their romantic apotheosis as artists possessed of a unique and unaccountable gift. Our task is to read Plato backwards, so to speak, to discover just what the artist and the craftsman have in common before Plato forces them to part ways. One of the central premises regarding techni that Plato shares with his predecessors and rivals, the Sophists, is the notion that a techni must, by definition, be teachable. That is to say, a techni must take as its object some human activity that is, in principle, repeatable, and not just by a single practitioner, but by a potentially infinite number of practitioners. This feature of repeatability is, in a way that comes across especially clearly in the papers by Professors Birl and Nagy, an essential characteristic of the performance medium that is archaic Greek poetry. In fact, it could be said that repeatability is the feature that distinguishes the artful logos of poetry from everyday speech. Poetry is speech that is worthy of being remembered, which is to say, of being reperformed on another occasion. All the more interesting, then, that Plato chose to use the innovative prose format of the Socraticos Logos, the Socratic dialogue, to stake out a claim in opposition to poetry for his own master techni, the dialectiki techni, or art of dialectic. The complexities of this choice and its execution in Plato's dialogues are a fascinating subject in their own right, but far beyond the limited scope of my objectives here. Suffice it to say that there are potential parallels with Professor Birl's image of sapphic monody perpetually conjuring choral poetry as its virtual double, or with Professor Martin's discussion of the way rhapsodes position themselves vis-a-vis their competitors, the Kitharodes. to return to the repeatability of techne. Repeatability also means necessarily transmissibility. Poetry, as the object of techne, is something that must be capable of being communicated to others, which means capable of being appropriated by them and embodied by them in subsequent performances. Professors Birol and Nagy offer the most instructive illustrations of this point, but all three of the papers amply demonstrate an all-important consequence of this notion of poetry as something fundamentally transmissible, a consequence that is too often ignored by many authoritative histories of ancient literature. The history of archaic Greek literature is necessarily the history of its reception. Even if we wish to retain, with Professor Birol, the possibility of access to a primary moment of production and reception, we must nevertheless recognize that no document we possess provides a record of this primary context, but only the traces of one or many acts of reception, of the re-situation or mise en œuvre of texts that were conceived with their own re-performance in mind. Rethinking the logos of poetry as techne, then, requires us to shift our thinking away from a romantic notion of art as an unrepeatable act of genius and toward a notion of art as practice, a practice that is fundamentally oriented toward transmission and reperformance, and that is supported by a variety of institutional frameworks. That is not to say that the notion of individual artistic excellence disappears from view. On the contrary, Professor Martin's fascinating discussion of the nexus between krisis and criterion, between judgment and the formulation of an aesthetics, reminds us that the institutional frameworks in question inexorably produce standards that are scrupulously applied to individual artists and performances. Moreover, the repetition of techne is not static, not locked into the mere reproduction of past performances. Professor Nagy, in his written paper, evokes Soren Kierkegaard's remarks in his essay on repetition to stress that the mimesis of archaic poetry is forward-oriented, looking beyond the present moment toward an eternal future of ever new realizations. Indeed, the most striking thing about many of our archaic texts is the way that they convey an awareness of this ongoing process of reception in reperformance, and the way that they seem to look forward to their future reception as the context for a fulfillment that is perpetually deferred. I am thinking now particularly of Professor Birol's compelling treatment of the erotics of longing and absence in the new Sappho text. As Birol notes, quote, "The deferral of love becomes its own song in the interruption and continuation of a reperformance," end quote. I'm quoting from the written version of his paper. The perpetual longing for an unattainable erotic fulfillment is a way of figuring the energy and dynamics of a medium that understands that it can never attain a definitive state of completion because it is always subject to a potentially endless series of future realizations. Nevertheless, the longing for such completion is what drives the cycle of performance and reperformance. The Alexandrian edition of Sappho set the entire sapphic corpus under the sign of this erotic and performative longing by beginning with the famous hymn to Aphrodite. The hymn begins with Sappho calling on the aid of an absent Aphrodite, whose presence is then conjured, summoned performatively when the speaker channels the voice of the goddess herself. Aphrodite speaks through the voice of the performer. One gap is therefore bridged, one absence is filled, but there is still a residue of erotic longing that looks forward to a future moment of completion. Aphrodite can only assure Sappho that if her beloved now flees, soon she will be the pursuer, soon she will give gifts, soon she will return Sappho's love. The insistent deferral encapsulated in this repeated soon corresponds performatively to the desire to stage ever new realizations of Sappho's voice, and textually to the desire to continue reading in search of the fulfillment promised by Aphrodite. I would like to stress that this dynamic of unattainable fulfillment pertains not only to Sappho's lyric poetics, but also in equal measure to the rhapsodic medium of Homeric poetry. The erotic longing highlighted by Professor Birrell finds its analog in a powerful observation made by Johannes Haubold in his book Homer's People. Examining the way in which the communities represented in the Iliad and the Odyssey are figured as the antecedents of the communities of historical Greek polis, Haubold notes that within the Homeric poems, communities never attain the kind of social stability and permanence they so clearly aspire to have. The fulfillment of this aspiration is instead deferred and projected into the world of the poem's reception, the world of performance in which the audiences of rhapsodic poetry, the descendants of the Homeric heroes, are engaged in the ongoing realization of their ancestors' aspirations. This is our world. The reality of ongoing performance, figured, as Professor Nagy argues in his paper, in the quadrennial reweaving of Athena's peplos, brings the heroic and mythic past into the realm of history, which is to say, into the realm of change, of development, and of elaboration. To practice a techne means precisely to take up the craft of another and to hand it on in turn in pursuit of a perfection that may not be attainable, but is not for that reason any less compelling as a goal. This afternoon's dialogue is a testament to the power of the techne of archaic Greek poetry to perpetuate itself in an ongoing process of reception. We are ourselves engaged today in the pursuit of that unattainable fulfillment that has always been the subject of great poetry. Thank you.